The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry today, and we thank you so much for listening. The Christmas weekend was marred by storms throughout the southern and central states, with floods and tornadoes killing at least 40 people and hampering travel for millions. Nearly a dozen people were killed after a series of tornadoes swept through metropolitan areas of eastern Texas near Dallas. The largest tornado, according to the National Weather Service, was rated an EF4. It packed winds up to 200 miles an hour. That one hit Garland, Texas, and in nearby Rowlett, about 600 homes and businesses were leveled. Power was knocked out all over the region. Vehicles were tossed from highways, accounting for most of the deaths. Tornadoes aren't new to this part of the country, but they are rare at this time of year. This was the first December EF4 in 15 years in the United States, and adding to the calamitous events, a blizzard hit the western part of Texas last night. Eric Austin is a reporter for KERA Public Media in Dallas, and he joins me now. Eric, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Describe the scene in Dallas over the Christmas weekend. It was a very, very tough Christmas there.
It certainly was. Saturday night, several storm warnings, tornado warnings, and severe thunderstorm warnings were issued. Tornado sirens were going off throughout the evening Saturday, starting around dinner time over the next few hours. Just these waves of warnings and sirens going off constantly. I live in Dallas, and my wife and I have two young kids, and we got bicycle helmets on them and brought them into a bathroom, an interior room with no windows to ride out the storm. But we didn't experience any damage in our neighborhood. But to the east, Garland and Rowlett were the hardest hit areas. Neighborhoods just devastated, neighborhood after neighborhood. Hundreds of homes. Some homes basically imploded. The roofs were ripped off and brick houses were just toppled, becoming a pile of bricks and two by fours pulverized by the storm, becoming toothpicks, trees uprooted, power lines down, trucks and cars flipped over. Certainly a major storm. And if you saw the images of the tornado on Saturday night, this was a huge, huge tornado, a wedge tornado, an ominous fat tornado. And it looked devastating by those images in social media and the television coverage. But you had to wait until Sunday morning with the rise of the sun to really understand the total devastation in those areas.
Tornadoes, as I mentioned, aren't rare in this part of the world. Were the warnings adequate? Were people able to get to safety?
People had been told that storms were coming, that we should be expecting storms. The National Weather Service and local television meteorologists had been issuing many alerts in the days leading up to Saturday. So people were aware that there was the potential for something to happen. The issue is you never quite know what's going to happen, where it's going to fall, how long it's going to last until it actually happens. So people were encouraged to stay home, to seek shelter, and a lot of folks did. Emergency officials are saying that it could have been much worse in terms of the death toll and the injury count, that folks who were inside their homes for the most part were able to survive. In Garland, however, where that EF4 tornado hit, 8 people died, but they all died in vehicle accidents, which is very noteworthy. A vehicle is the worst place you want to be when a tornado strikes, and these folks were apparently driving down one of two highways, and the tornado was so strong, or the winds from the storm were so strong, that they started pushing these cars around, some of them off an overpass onto the ground below, and there could have been some accidents as a result of that. They're still trying to piece together the details, but 8 of the 11 people died involving vehicle accidents in Garland. So a word of warning to folks, you know, here on down the road is to stay off the roads when major storms are coming through.
Eric Austin, northwest of you in Dallas is the Texas Panhandle, which has also experienced some terrible weather and a massive blizzard just north of there in Oklahoma. 9 inches of rain in one region of Oklahoma, a major disaster there as well.
Definitely. Amarillo, which is the big city in the Panhandle, is about 5 hours northwest of Dallas-Fort Worth, and areas in the Texas Panhandle have seen perhaps about a foot of snow so far, and traffic has been tied up. Interstate 40, which is a major thoroughfare between New Mexico going through Texas, the Texas Panhandle, and into Oklahoma, most of Interstate 40 has been shut down because of the intense weather. They're encouraging folks to stay off the highway, stay off the roads. A small part of it is open in Amarillo. There are reports of traffic tie-ups throughout throughout the western part of the state as the blizzard moves through. Dallas-Fort Worth should see some of that as the day rolls along, but we're not expecting anything intense, perhaps a couple inches of snow to the west of Dallas-Fort Worth. But if the snow does fall, it should not stick, should not accumulate. And so we're not expecting any major weather hazards in the immediate Dallas-Fort Worth area.
And in the aftermath there in Dallas-Fort Worth and across Texas, the emergency response, how has it been?
I think people have been satisfied with the response so far. Local mayors have been offering frequent updates. Police and emergency responders got into these areas quickly on Saturday night. There were some looky-loos, some people who didn't live in the areas who were impeding traffic, but they were able to get around that pretty quickly. In the city of Garland, for example, they spent the day Sunday searching practically every affected home and car looking for any injured or survivors. The death toll, though, remains at 11. They didn't find any new deaths in Garland on Sunday. The governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, issued a state of disaster for four North Texas counties, promising the help of the Texas Department of Public Safety, as well as the Texas State and National Guard. Local emergency responders have been praised for constant communication among different agencies in different cities, helping each other out in the minutes after the storm hit. So I have not seen a lot of criticism about the emergency response.
11 people killed in the Dallas-Fort Worth area by tornadoes, and many, many more across other states due to severe weather, blizzards, rain, and storms. Eric Austin, reporter with KERA Public Media in Dallas, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And we want to hear from you. Is Mother Nature acting oddly where you live? Mary says tulips are blooming, flowering, trees are blooming, parsley is still growing. It's 70 degrees on Sunday evening here at 6 p.m. outside of Philadelphia. Michael from Seattle, Washington has had a drought each summer for the last couple of years. As a result, we've had major fires. Today it snowed.
This is Adem Cardona from Portland, Oregon. My brother had to duck and cover from yesterday's tornado in Texas. We had record-breaking drought last summer, followed by record-breaking rain and flooding this winter. Dear world leaders, stop racing around the planet in jumbo jets to talk about global warming. You've been told what needs to be done. Just freaking do it.
We always want to hear from you. You can tweet us at The Takeaway or comment at the website at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, funding cancer research across the continuum, from basic research through clinical trials to advanced therapies that save thousands of lives. More information is available at lls.org.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. After the terror attacks in Paris last November, and even before, some in Congress began calling for new laws that would allow the government to monitor encrypted mobile communications on phones and also on apps like WhatsApp and Telegram. Unnamed officials told the Washington Post that the terrorists in Paris used such apps to plan their attacks. And it's not the only attack where encrypted apps have been part of the picture. FBI Director James Comey has been warning Congress about the issue for months.
The world has changed in the last 2 years. Decryption has moved from being something available to something that is the default.
That's James Comey testifying before Congress last July. Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance says it's also a problem for state and local law enforcement. Not just for terror, but for more familiar crimes. And not just apps, but the phones themselves, especially after Google and Apple began marketing locked and unbreakable phones last year. I sat down with Vance for the first of three conversations over the next few days here on The Takeaway on encryption, law enforcement, and privacy.
Up until September of last year, the unencrypted material on the cell phones could be searched, and that's exactly what we did. If a judge determined there was probable cause to search a phone, we would get that warrant and an unlocking order, send that phone out to Apple. Apple would open the phone with its own digital key, download the relevant material called for in the warrant, and send it back to us. But since they have changed their operating system, they have now engineered it so that they can no longer open their own devices. And the only person who can open that device is the owner of the device or someone else to whom the owner has shared the password. And so that's the game changer.
There are very real privacy concerns here as well, and I think that's part of the reason why you've been out in the media giving your opinion on this. You say you don't want a backdoor into these devices, and yet a backdoor is precisely what a lot of people have been calling for. George Pataki in a Republican debate called for precisely that. And certainly, even if it's for the greater good, in your opinion, weakening smartphone security seems to be exactly what you're calling for.
Well, Todd, I can't speak for what those running for president, how they characterize what they want. I don't want a backdoor. What I want to do is to have Apple be able to maintain in its own possession, in its own secure locations, a digital key to unlock its own devices. I don't want a key. I don't want the key escrowed with a third party. All I want Apple to do is, when a judge has determined by looking at a criminal case that there's a need to get into this device and issues an order, that order can be effectuated, and the evidence, which by the way is evidence that's we're trying to put together to deal with the thousands and thousands of state cases all around the country. That's the evidence we're trying to achieve. But here, Todd, where I come down on all this, if I may, is that I may not be able to convince you that there is a compelling and absolute need for cell phones to be able to be opened upon execution of a warrant by a judge. But what I do think is important is that the decision to change the ground rules was made by Apple and Google independently with no notice to law enforcement that I'm aware of. And when they made that decision, they themselves have decided that they know where to draw the line between privacy and public safety. And they've drawn it where it also happens to fit their economic interests. What I'm saying is, like any organizations that mature, business organizations that become integral to the way we do business and live our lives in society, telephone companies had to come to terms with the fact that they had to give law enforcement upon a warrant opportunity to intercept communications that were deemed to be criminally related. Apple and Google are no longer teenagers in the business world of the internet. They are the absolute dominating mature adults with 96.4% of the smartphone market. Given that it is a fact that people use smartphones for legitimate purposes and also a fact that they use it for illegitimate purposes, there has to be an examination of this issue by legislators so that the balance that is ultimately struck between privacy and public safety is one after informed consideration and not, in my personal opinion, based upon the decision of two companies who are obviously concerned about their business interests and the decisions they make.
James Comey has made the point before Congress, expressing his frustration about being blind when it comes to a lot of these devices and apps, that it's akin to a locked door, that the FBI, with a judge's permission, has the ability to look in locked doors to prevent crimes, and people want that. But if the lock happens to be made by Company X, I guess, and for the purposes of this discussion, Apple, that they can't open it, and they're not allowed to open it just because the lock is made by a certain company, and that to him that makes no sense, and he says it shouldn't make sense to phone users either.
Well, I on that point, I agree with the director entirely. And we have to, in my opinion, separate the searches by federal agencies that have so upset people with the kinds of searches that I'm talking about. I'm talking not about bulk data collection. I'm not talking about scooping up the information of millions of people. To the contrary, every phone that we seek to open is done by an individual separate presentation of facts to a judge. It's very much retail law enforcement investigation. I think it's also important to understand that access to these digital devices is equally important in terms of potential exonerations of individuals as it is to obtain convictions. Information on these smartphones can now contain a huge amount of data, as you know. And if we can't access the data in an investigation, let's say to a homicide, we may be unable to access data which would demonstrate that the individual that we suspect committed a crime did not, in fact. And there's a case in our office that really proved that point, where a young assistant in our office picked up a case where the defendants had made an arrest in a homicide. But over the course of a weekend, that young assistant became concerned that the detectives had, in fact, arrested the wrong person. It was the assistant's ability through digital forensic examinations, not only of cell site analysis, but of the cell phones themselves, that ultimately enabled, over the course of 3 days, him to be able to determine that the man arrested was not guilty. They could identify subsequently the man who did it, who is now serving a substantial prison term for homicide in state prison. So access to these stored digital evidence in cell phones is not just important for enforcement and conviction. It's equally important to make sure that we are only charging those people who, in fact, committed crimes.
Law enforcement officials from the director of the FBI to district attorneys are warning that Apple and Google devices are locked, making them blind to crimes in progress and crimes that have been committed. Cyrus Vance Jr. is one of them. He's the Manhattan district attorney. Cyrus Vance, thank you.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a brain training program, performance can be compared with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Yet another police shooting in Chicago left two dead on early Saturday morning, including 55-year-old Betty Jones, who police say was accidentally struck and tragically killed. The latest shooting, of course, just adds to already high tensions in Chicago. Late last month, Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan asked Chicago police to release the dashboard camera video capturing the death of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald, who was killed by officers during a confrontation in October 2014. It was a judge's order that eventually forced the release of that video. Outrage around the footage pushed Madigan to then call on the Justice Department for an outside independent investigation into the pattern and practices of the Chicago PD. U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch announced that investigation was underway on December 7th. Laquan McDonald's death might have gone unnoticed altogether if not for the eventual release of that dashboard cam video that police wanted to keep hidden. The video confirmed what Illinois Attorney General Lisa Madigan says many had suspected, that Laquan McDonald's death did not happen the way police said it did.
I think there's really outrage around that. We actually had a request by a reporter to have access to that video. And out of the Attorney General's office, we said that needed to be released, that you cannot hold that under the Freedom of Information Act. But unfortunately, there's been a history where it's the Chicago Police Department who has tried to prevent those videos from being released. And, you know, at this point, this day and age, because of the technology and in other places around the country, those videos are coming out much sooner, and that needs to be the situation in Chicago as well.
There's a long pattern of police shootings in that city. And in fact, in 2007, you guys instituted the Independent Police Review Authority, which was supposed to review shootings like this and make recommendations. Has it been a failure? Do we know enough yet to say that that effort dating back to 2007 has been a failure for the people of Chicago and for police accountability?
I think there is a belief that the Independent Police Review Authority has been a failure, but I think it remains to be seen. And that is certainly one of the main focuses of what is going to be looked at by not just the Department of Justice, but also going to be looked at by the City of Chicago and the Police Department, because clearly when you have a circumstance that virtually never is there a determination that something went wrong, comes to a police-civilian interaction, shooting, misconduct, you know, that's unlikely to truly be the case.
It's one thing for DOJ to be investigating patterns or practices. How do you change an entrenched generations-old culture inside the police department?
Well, I think we've seen over the years that you have these problems across the country. And in fact, the federal statute that gives the Department of Justice the authority to come in and do these pattern and practice investigations was initially passed in the aftermath of the Rodney King situation out in Los Angeles. And so we have seen that you can effectively identify the problems that are out there, put in place solutions, and actually have real reform when the public demands it, when the law demands it, and when there's actual accountability from top to bottom. And I believe that it's really, you know, the last best hope that we've got in terms of being able to do that. But it is one that the entire public, really, of the City of Chicago is demanding at this point.
We have seen situations in many cities where it appears that officers who do wrong hide behind the legal, I'll call them loopholes for lack of a better word. Does Illinois need a change in the statute that gives officers as much leeway as they have?
I certainly think that's one of the issues that will be looked at. But already there are conversations underway with members of the legislature about what do we need to do on a statewide basis. The Illinois legislature already this past year took some enormous steps in putting in place what appears to be very good law in terms of the use of body-worn cameras, trainings that are required of law enforcement. And they will actually, those laws will be coming online as the year begins. So we've got some very good things, but there's a lot to be done, particularly when it comes to community policing efforts and reestablishing what is essential trust in communities.
Is this really, when it comes down to it, in Chicago, a question of now there's video that shows the problem that's existed for all these many years?
I think that's true across the country. That is the promise of technology, is that it has been able in many circumstances to bring forth what is really, unfortunately, a day-to-day reality in far too many communities throughout this country. I actually think that the technology is a great advance, and we just have to make sure that we are benefiting from it.
Lisa Madigan, thank you for your time.
Todd, you're very welcome.
Lisa Madigan is Attorney General for the state of Illinois. Human rights activists usually look to developing countries when they're examining the issue of child marriage. After all, one-third of girls in the developing world are married before the age of 18, and 1 in 9 are married before the age of 15. But child marriage isn't only a problem in the third world. It's also an issue right here in the United States. The fact is that thousands of children have been married in the U.S. in recent years. Between 2000 and 2010, 3,853 children were married just in New York State. Freddie Reese is here with more hard facts about child marriage in America. She's the executive director of Unchained at Last. That's a nonprofit that helps women and girls leave or avoid arranged and forced marriages. And she joins me in the studio. Freddie Reese, welcome.
Thank you very much.
This is an issue that most Americans haven't heard about, or they assume doesn't go on in their country. How common is child marriage in the United States?
We still don't have a very good sense of how common child marriage is in the United States. So the numbers that you just said about New York State, more than 3,800 children married in that 10-year period, that was an op-ed that I wrote in the New York Times that revealed those numbers. We also looked in New Jersey, and we found really startling similar numbers, thousands of children getting married in recent years. And we still have another 48 states to go where we need to retrieve the data and find out how many children are getting married. The fact is, though, that while 18 is the minimum marriage age in most U.S. states, every U.S. state allows exceptions under which children under age 18 can get married.
And every state is different, of course, but give us a general sense of what the exceptions are. I imagine parental consent is one.
Yeah, so parental consent is a common exception, and that typically lowers the marriage age to age 16. And the problem with parental consent is that there is no process in place to ensure that it's not actually parental coercion. And so even in a situation where a girl is sobbing openly and doesn't want this marriage, her parents can sign the marriage license application and force her into a marriage without the clerk having any authority to intervene in that situation. And then another common exception, and that's in New Jersey and in New York and in a lot of other states, is judicial approval. So if a judge approves the marriage, that lowers the age even more. And in many states, there is no minimum age below which a judge is no longer allowed to approve a marriage.
Okay, but on what grounds would a judge justify approving the marriage of, I don't know, a 14 or a 13-year-old?
Or even younger. In New Jersey, we found a 10-year-old who was married in 2006. The problem is that there really are, in a lot of states, no criteria put in place. So there is nothing that tells a judge you can approve this marriage but not that marriage. So there, it's at, really at a judge's discretion. And what we have found is that judges have been allowing marriages often at ages or with age differences that would be considered statutory rape under state law.
Now, I assume in most of these cases that the age dichotomy would be a very young girl marrying an older man. Is that correct, that that's most of those cases?
That's most of the cases. So what we found is that overwhelmingly these were girls, and overwhelmingly they were being married to adults.
And we don't know from public records what the source of such a disparate marriage in terms of age is, whether it's religious orthodoxy or some kind of cultish behavior. We just don't know from public records, right?
Correct. So the information that we received so far shows only age of bride, age of groom, and no other demographic or identifying information about these children who are married. We do know, though, from a nationwide survey that was done in 2011 by the Tahereh Justice Center, that forced and or child marriage were happening in immigrant communities from 56 different countries of origin in Asia, Europe, Africa, and the Americas, and in many different religious communities.
Does that mean that ending this practice is changing the laws so that types of practices that are commonplace in other countries but frowned upon here aren't imported?
Well, yes, and that's, and keep in mind that the Tahereh survey focused on immigrant communities, but it did also find that this is happening in so-called American communities and in American families, and we have seen that also at Unchained at Last. So this is not only an immigrant issue. But yeah, there are some laws that we need to put into place so that these kinds of practices that are harmful to children, whether it's coming from religious, cultural, immigrant, wherever it's coming from, American, immigrant, we need to put a stop to this. And so, of course, ending those exceptions that allow children to get married, that's a no-brainer, of course.
We don't make a whole lot of national marriage law in this country, so you're talking about an effort that's going to have to go to 50 state governments in the District of Columbia and territories as well. So what does that mean?
It means I'm not going to be getting a whole lot of sleep over the coming years. Right. I don't think at last we've written legislation in New York, New Jersey. We're working with legislators in those two states to get those laws introduced and then passed, and then 48 states to go.
What does the legislation say? Does it say 18 no exceptions, or does it allow a 17-year-old to make a case? What does it say?
Marriage is a legal contract, and like other contracts, should be reserved for those who have reached the age of majority, which is 18. So the legislation that I would like to see introduced is 18, no exceptions under that. I understand there might be some pushback and there might be some legislators and others who will come forward and say there's absolutely no way you can pass that with no exceptions. And in that case, I'm willing to talk about some reasonable exceptions.
There's a long tradition in this country. For instance, a lot of it's in lore, but we all know in the common culture of 16-year-old couple getting pregnant and getting married because they got pregnant young. You would do away with that.
Absolutely. So a pregnancy exception is not one that I consider to be reasonable. Pregnancy exceptions have been found to be bad public policy, and states, in fact, have been moving away from those. Girls who are pregnant need as much protection from forced marriage, if not more, than any other girl.
If I were your opponent in a legislature and you came to me with that argument, I might say pregnant moms and dads should have the option of forming a family even if they're young. Don't stand in the way.
Sure. They have the option to create a family. But that doesn't mean they need to get married, first of all. And also, they can get married as soon as both parties are 18. But actually, for a long time, there's been this push to have children married within wedlock based on the assumption that that was in the best interest of mother and child. And that's been proved not to be true. In fact, teenage mothers who do not get married turn out to have long-term to be less likely to end up living in poverty, because age is the single most significant predictor of marital failure. The younger you are when you get married, the absolute more likely you are to get divorced. And when you get married at a really young age and get divorced, you're much more likely to end up living in poverty. So it's actually better off, public policy, we're better off telling children to wait to get married until they turn 18.
I can see a religious freedom exception argument here as well that you're going to face in a lot of places where conservative communities that have traditions of daughters getting married at 17 or 16 or what have you will say that this is a violation of their freedom to practice their religion as they see fit.
Oh, there are a lot of things that we don't allow people to do that can be argued that it somehow infringes on their religious rights. But remember, we're not saying you can't get married. We're just saying wait until you're 18.
Freddie Reese is executive director of Unchained at Last. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
The internet started out as a military application. Networks of computers linked together to steer ships, target missiles, and help commanders communicate with each other. Once the internet became public, it was supposed to be a borderless, unregulated landscape of information, the great democratizer that equalized the world in a way that we've never seen. That's not happening. Individual countries are now hard at work to set their own rules to limit and shape the internet that their citizens see. They're slowly carving up the internet for their own purposes, including censorship, but also surveillance. Meanwhile, away from the common internet that you and I see, governments are quickly walling off closed military networks that my next guest says can increase the chances of cyber warfare. Scott Malcolmson calls this fractured cyberspace the splinternet. He's a fellow at the Carnegie Corporation and author of the forthcoming book called Splinternet, How Geopolitics and Commerce Are Fragmenting the World Wide Web. Scott Malcolmson, welcome.
Thanks for having me in.
What has happened to the original promise of the internet that I talked about, the universal, open, and uncensored internet that would unify and elevate disparate people? Was that Pollyanna?
Well, to a degree, it was definitely Pollyanna-ish. It was an environment in the 1990s that had grown out of, as you said, a military project of many decades standing. The inhabitants, so to speak, of cyberspace in the mid-90s tended to be pretty specialized. They tended to be engineers and other internet enthusiasts. It was a subculture that felt that it was the vanguard of a world where all citizens would be able to go online, escape geography, escape the control of governments, escape even their own physical identities, and create new communities of choice. It was a fantastically interesting and exhilarating world, but it only lasted, I would say, until the end of the 1990s, at which point both the commercial imperative of making that world profitable, and then not long after that, the state imperative of making it, from the state's point of view, safe, overtook the free cyberspace that had been the focus of so much wonderful idealism and creativity in the mid-90s.
We'll get to the U.S. Describe exactly what countries like China and Russia are now doing in public. It's not secret. They have described their goals in walling off the internet. What are they doing?
The simplest summation of it is in Chinese President Xi Jinping's phrase, internet sovereignty. The idea being that the internet is a place that, just like the terrestrial world, is subject to the sovereign control of whichever government controls the territory. So internet sovereignty basically means government sovereignty over the internet as it reaches its citizens. So in the end, it's an expression of control over the citizens rather than control over the internet. China has been a leader in that for a number of years, but Russia has been doing the same thing. Other countries, Brazil, for example, at one point was talking a lot about how servers had to be located on its territory. India has its own plans. And Europe, of course, usually in terms of privacy law and in terms of hate speech law, both laws that are taken to an extent that would not happen in the United States, Europe is reasserting its control over the internet as well. So those are the main, basically any large power that feels it has a significant stake and control over the internet and has the power and the financial means and the technical means to assert that control is asserting it.
Is it fair to say that the U.S. government view of the internet now is we want it open and uncensored and unfettered, but we want to be able to watch?
Yes, I think that's right. That expresses itself in the encryption debate. That also expresses itself in the debate over what to do with terrorism and social media, which is a very interesting parallel discussion because in that case, the big social media outfits have done what they did for 10 years, which is with child pornography and so on, which is that they try to keep those discussions off. They take on a private responsibility based on their terms of service, which of course no one has ever read, that basically say that these things shouldn't be done online. But it's up to the companies to essentially surveil their own users. And they do that chiefly because they don't want governments to be doing it. And if they don't do it themselves, then governments will insist on doing it. And that's happening right now in the case of terrorism with some initiatives from Secretary Hillary Clinton, Senator Dianne Feinstein and others trying to basically strengthen the government's hand in surveilling and keeping terrorist speech off of social media.
It makes plenty of intuitive sense why militaries around the world would want to have their own networks. They don't want to be dependent on networks that the United States has control of, at least through a lot of its companies, to be vulnerable to attacks. That makes sense. You have said, though, that this is a dangerous development, that it increases the chances of cyber warfare. Why does it do that?
I think that as governments increase their dependence on the internet and on networked computers for the projection of force, then they will begin to seek, or they are already seeking, ways to attack each other's computers, ways to attack each other's servers, basically, or to interrupt the command and control that any modern military uses technology for. And so there's a kind of machine-to-machine aggression that is being looked at a lot, and the means for it are being developed by the world's major militaries. Should there be an exacerbated political conflict between two such countries, they will be in a position in just another few years to be able to feel that they might attack each other's machines rather than attacking each other's people, and that this is something that would essentially, in my view, open up a slippery slope towards conflict. Any time two states feel that they can engage each other militarily while minimizing certain kinds of costs, it becomes a temptation to go ahead and do it. And my greatest worry is that as these very nervous militaries at major countries who depend on this technology for basic military functions now, such as directing aircraft, directing fire, that their dependence will create a kind of insecurity that will reach a point where they want to strike others' machines, thinking that they're only hitting machines, but that this could then trigger a conflict that would involve human bodies as well.
Scott Malcolmson is a fellow at the Carnegie Corporation. His upcoming book is SplinterNet, How Geopolitics and Commerce Are Fragmenting the World Wide Web. It's available now for pre-order at orbooks.com. Scott Malcolmson, thank you.
Thank you.
Throughout the show today, we're hearing from you about the strange and severe weather hitting your communities this year.
This is Mark from Michigan. Here we have had record warmth to the point where I've actually seen lilacs starting to bud in December. But don't worry, an ice storm's on its way with freezing rain, sleet, high winds, power failures. For where I live, that's much more normal.
Share your take with us at 8778-MY-TAKE. And a reminder, we want you to get an early jump on all of our conversations. You can be part of our listener response network by signing up for our text. You get one text each day where we ask you a question featured on the next day's show so that your voice becomes part of our on-air conversation. Just text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866. Messaging and data rates apply, of course, and you can reply STOP to opt out. And here's something to take with you today. Back on this day in 1981, a little girl named Elizabeth Jordan Carr was born. She was the first child born via in vitro fertilization in the United States. It took 43 tries before Elizabeth was born. At that time, the novelty was called a test tube baby. Today, 61,000 babies are born each year in the U.S. via IVF. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, sitting in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, which has funded research that led to blood cancer treatments such as chemotherapy and stem cell transplants, and more recently, targeted therapies and immunotherapies to save thousands of lives. More at lls.org.
The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.